Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein from New York City. And this week we have a fascinating show. It's a continuation of what we spoke about last week. Predators in our midst. Do we allow them to remain part of our community or not? You walk into Shul and there's one of these super predators. It could be a financial predator. It could be a sexual predator. It could be somebody who created a great Chilul Hashem, the issue. Do we keep them in Shul? Do you allow such a person in Shul? You know, well, they have to daven someplace. What are they going to do? Skip davening? So, we're obviously talking about a predator who's been defanged, because if they're a current and present danger, they should be in jail. But once they're not a danger anymore, so interestingly, there is no case on point for this. You know, we like to talk halacha here. The closest thing that I could find is if you look in Yeridei Shin Lamed Aleph, Hilchos Nidui and Cherem, there's actually a Ramah. And Ramah talks about somebody who's put in Cherem. And Ramah says, we keep him in Cherem. This is in Sif Aleph. Afal pi shechoshishin sheyetze letarbus ra. Even if we are afraid, if by excommunicating, he will become a Meshumid. He will leave the religion totally. Now, think of the extreme. In the Ramah's case, we can put somebody in Cherem for as minor of a problem as not listening to a halacha drabanan. And Ramah says, if you want to enforce it and he refuses, you can put him in Cherem even if he'll be Yetzel Atarbasra. Forget about missing davening. Even if he converts. Interestingly, the Taz argues, and the Taz says, Ein Doichen Evin Afra Neufel. When somebody's down, you don't throw a rock on top of them. And they go back and forth. Many of the Paiskim, the Chavis Yoyer, the Chsam Seifer, many discuss it. But ultimately, the great Shach writes, we Paskin like the Ramoi says, Dim Loikein Botla Din Yisrael. There would be no more sense of din by Kval Yisrael if we would allow transgressors to trample on the law. We'd say, oh my goodness, we can't punish him. Maybe he'll become a religious. He says, no, we enforce the halacha, and that be it. We just don't want you. Now, the problem with this citation of Shin Lamed Aleph is that Nidui and Cherem is talking about injunctive relief. What can we do to stop someone in the tracks of their behavior? It's not talking about somebody who's already been defanged, somebody who's been discovered, they've been sort of outed, the community knows who they are, how dangerous they are, etc. It doesn't discuss that. The concept of should we continue to excommunicate or punish somebody, l'man yishmu v'yiro, so that people should understand you can't try to, if you're in a ship, you can't go down to your room and drill a hole in the floor of yours and say, well, it's just my room. We're a ship, Klal Yisrael, Kol Yisrael arevim zelazeh. We are responsible for each other. We've built an astounding, a fantastic, amazing community where people care for each other. We have, you know, tzedakah. We have yarchei kalas. For Shabbos, we have taimchei Shabbos. We have clothing. We have organizations that will give you a kidney, help you with your tuition. So it's a community that supports one each other. When you have somebody who's trying to drill a hole in the bottom of the boat, well, should the community excommunicate such a person? Or do we say, listen, the person has been humiliated, and the concept of L'man Yishmu V'yiro, to set an example, others should see, you can't do so much destruction to our community. We will not allow it. Maybe we don't allow for that. Maybe we shouldn't be doing it. There is no clear halacha on point for this. The Ramah in Shin Lamed Aleph Tzivav says that if somebody is a nidui, he says, Ein Moilin es Banav, we don't mal his children, Ein Koivrin es Mesa, if somebody in his family dies, we don't bury the body. Imagine that. You let the body rot. Ramah was serious. You know, they say that today football is not as bad as it used to be. It used to be that, you know, today they sack the quarterback. In the olden days, when I was growing up, after they finished with the quarterback, they went into the stands and they sacked his family as well. So the Ramah says, You don't mal as children, and kaibun as mesai, drumas as zorkin as banav, mi beis ha-sefer. You throw his children out of the beis ha-sefer. And ishtai, you send his wife from shul. And why is this? To set an example. We as a community, we can't allow destructors, destroyers, haters, malshinim to come in and try to destroy us from our very midst. Turn our kindness into a tool of destruction. Now the Marshal, the Taz on the spot brings him, argues vigorously. He says, even if you want to have venom towards the perpetrator, he says, why is the family guilty? And you'll see the Pesachei Tshuva there brings the Chassam Sofer struggle with this, and the Chassam Sofer says, we only ask the family, he tries to make a compromise, we only hold the family guilty if we believe that they follow in the paths of their parents. He says, like a karoi, a heretic, his children are probably heretics. Other places can disagree. But here again, we're talking about injunctive relief. Somebody who is not makabel the nidai, maybe somebody who is defanged, is different. Before we go to our guests, it's Parshas Lech Lecha. I'm not going to proceed this, you know, rather austere topic with the Dvar Torah on the Parsha, but I will say the entire Ramah in Sivav, which says we punish the children, the spouse, etc., is deeply troubling because it goes to collective punishment. You know, the Nazis, if somebody escaped the camp, they would line up 30 random people and shoot them all. And the message was, if you try to escape, we're going to kill 30 of you. And, you know, that's problematic. That's what did these 30 people, right? So interestingly, the Rivash, the great Pesach, the Rivash, he lived around the 1400s, around 600 years ago. He actually was asked this question. He says, can we do collective punishment? You know, a few people of a community sin, so we want to punish many. And he says, Chas v'shalom, the Rivash says. He says, and he brings a raya from Parshas of Ayera, next week's Parsha. He says, what did Avram say when the Rabbeinu Shalom tries to punish Sadaim? Avram says, Chalila l'chalies l'hamis tzadik im Rasha, v'hayaka tzadik ha-Rasha. He says, God forbid. He says, Lord, ha'isa mishpat, how could you allow the tzadik to pay for the Rasha? And then he brings from Moshe. He says, ha'ish echad yechtev al kol ha'edev tiktayv. And then he brings the Gemara. The Gemara says, Tuvya chada zagid nagid, that one person sins and another person. He says collective punishment is not allowed. Yet the Ramah here seemingly struggles. The Ramah says, we have a machlaikis. The Marshal on the spot argues with the Ramah. Do we allow for collective punishment? What's your opinion? Somebody did something really terrible. Somebody like Dwecki destroyed the lives of 13 Rabbanim, an entire community. Do we allow it? Do we say, okay, you know, you're out, but your family is fully accepted? Or do we say, you know, we have to create an example to protect ourselves? Ramah says one thing, Marshal says the other, Rivash says collective punishment, chas v'shalom. I'll leave you with one other question. I'll leave you with a question on the Rivash. I mean, the Rivash could clearly argue on the Ramah. The Ramah came later than the Rivash. But what would the Rivash say? He says, Chalil lecha l'hamis tzadik im rasha. We don't believe in collective punishment. If you look in Hilchos Avodah Zarah in the Rambam, in Perek Dalad, the Migdal Oiz, the Rambam says that by ir hanidachas, you would kill the children too. So the Migdal Oiz brings from Yitzchak from Malta. I'm sorry, Reb Moshe from Malta, the Ramah, the Yad Ramah, he lives, he came from Malta. I was actually, years ago, I was in Malta, and they took me by boat to a little island, and they say, a great rabbi was buried here. It was the Yad Ramah. Reb Moshe Abulefya was buried on an island off of Malta, a little stony, rocky island, uninhabited. He asked this question. He says, why should the children pay for the parents? And he remains by a question. And Rabbi Aaron Meluniel, one of the great Bali Taisvah, says, well, I'll bring you three proofs that we do believe in collective punishment. He says, B'nai Kairach, they died. What did they do? The children, it says, the earth opened and it swallowed everything. Anashim, Nashim, V'taf. Right? He said, the Taf, why did they die of all the people there? Well, B'nai Kerach Lebesu, but the Taf, everybody else did that. He says, you see, we do believe in collective punishment, right? He says, additionally, he says, in the case of, we have here Nidachas, we have Kairach, and then he says, in the case of Yavish B'Gilad, he says, also the children died. So we have Kairach, Irani Dachas, Yavish Begilad, collective punishment. The Rivash says, this next week's parsha, Chalila Chalaham is Sadik in Russia. He brings from Moshe, Ha'ish Echad, Yechdev al Kalei de Tiktaif, Tuv Yechata of Azigud Nagid, you're one person, the other person. How would the Rivash answer these problems? These are really difficult problems. What? How did the Jews believe, deal with collective punishment? And rather than try to answer it, we have such an audience of brilliant, amazing Talmid HaChamim, philosophers. If you have an answer, please email it to me. So we're going to go to the phone now. We're going to start with a very courageous rabbi from Baltimore, Rabbi Tzvi Weiss. We have on the phone with us, from Baltimore, Maryland, Harav Tzvi Weiss, who's the Mara de Asra of Beis HaKnesses Arachayim. Welcome, Reb Tzvi.
Welcome. Thank you for the opportunity, and it's good to talk to you.
So here's the question we'd like to pose to you. When we have somebody who has been a major embarrassment, a source of grief, somebody who's been a machriv hatzibur, right? How do we post-facto, when they're not a danger anymore, they're not a roidif anymore, they are not a predator anymore, they are not, you know, being right of us, either beguf, benefesh, bemamain, whatever the case may be, but they cause so much embarrassment. How do we deal with them as a tzibur? Is there a concept of l'man yishmu ve'yiro, we should be merachik such a person to show that our community has standards? We've built a beautiful community, and if you want to try to destroy the beautiful community, we don't want you to send a warning out to others. What is the Rav's opinion?
This is, Reb David, this is a complicated, sensitive issue. It's not a shaila from today or the last 50 or 100 years. It's a shaila that has come up throughout our history, hundreds of years, probably thousands of years. I mean, Baruch Hashem, Klal Yisrael, from its initial existence until today, has had multitudes, ruba de ruba, of Yidden who were erlich, did the right thing, created Kiddush Hashem as individuals and as part of a tzibur. But unfortunately, in the world that is, people have free choice, they have free will, they have bechira, there's all kinds of challenges, and there have been those individuals who have behaved in horrific, harmful ways, both to themselves spiritually, to their families, to their communities. There have been chaytil machte, there have been, as you said before, machrive hatzibur, dangers to society as individuals and as groups. The shilas that go back about this issue when they talk about, you know, the groups of Shabsai Tzvi and so on, who were out there and recruiting and pulling Yidden away from doing the right thing. And it's a complicated shila. You know, to give one, obviously one cookie-cutter answer would not work. We're talking here theoretical. Every individual in every case has to be judged on its merits and be looked into with a tremendous amount of all kinds of emotions. Compassion, both for the individual who went off, compassion for the people around him, compassion for the tzibur that is subject to what we just talked about.
Now, Reb Tzvi, let me just illuminate the tzibur at large why I'm asking you this question. Mm-hmm. A while ago, a fellow by the name of Dweck, who caused one of the greatest Chilul Hashems, certainly in my lifetime, moved into the Baltimore community where you are a very prominent Rav. And he said, you know, Emani kan hakol kan. He moved in, he registered his children in the local Beis Yaakov. And I understand that, you know, there was some consternation in the community as how to deal with him. And you were very involved, and which is why I put the shaila to your feet, we haven't chosen you out of a hat, but out of somebody who actually had to deal and struggle with this very issue.
Well, look, Reb David, unfortunately, as a Rav in a community, these kinds of issues are going to present themselves, and our responsibility, the way I understand it, and the other Rabbanim in our community, and I'm sure all over the world, understand that we can't run away from these situations, and we have to take them on head first. I don't want to talk about any individual case, but, you know, in the case that you mention is a little bit different than the Shaila that you posed. When that individual moved or attempted to move to our community from outside the community, at that point he was still deemed to be a danger to the society around him. And therefore it was dealt by the Rabbanim, by the local Rabbanim, in that, from that frame of mind, from that point of consideration that we have over here. You know, what you said before, we're not talking about a case of a Raidif. We're not talking, his situation was seen very clearly, and a judgment had to be made. Is this a Raidif? Is this somebody who was going to enter into our community and start behaving in the ways that he behaved before without remorse, looking for helpless victims, and going to cause a tremendous amount of tsar, beguf, b'mamon, and benefesh? So that's how that approach to that case was taken, from that frame of mind. There are other cases of, you know, sexual predators, where it is almost impossible, from my opinion and from the experts that I've spoken to, for anyone to get up and say, oh, that fella's cured, he's no longer a danger to society. And therefore, those cases also have to be looked at from that standpoint. And though the question comes up about the innocent children of the perpetrator, of the predators, his children, you know, we have to look at it from the standpoint of protecting our children, the innocent children who are unrelated to the story. So the case that you bring up, it was a painful case. We dealt with it properly as a group of Rabbanim. We were meyayitz, and we came to a very good conclusion at that point. But again, it's different than the Shaila that you're asking.
See, what halachic precedent would you establish for a lot of people? Here are the two arguments. Look, he has to have some place to daven. We can't stop somebody from davening. Question number one.
Of course we can stop people from davening.
Good. So give our Rilam some halachic precedents. Just teach our Rilam.
A tiny bit, you know, if you open up a Shulchan Aruch, and look, nobody should attempt, you know, this is dangerous, do not attempt it at home, like they say, it's a disclaimer, but we have to get educated. You know, the Shulchan Aruch and Shin Lamed Aleph, it's Hilchos Nidui V'Cheirim, and there it's talking about a case where a fellow was put into a Nidui because he was an Avarium, which means he didn't behave properly, not necessarily that he enticed others, not that he was a harm or a threat or a predator. We're not talking about sexual predators. Those cases do come
even
up.
In Issa Drabanan, even in Issa Drabanan.
In his own, within his own Dalet Amis, in the privacy of his own home, he is not following the halacha. So the tzibur then, I don't know if today they understand it, but the tzibur then understood that just like we have a responsibility for each other's well-being, Baruch Hashem, the Moistus HaChesed that exists in our communities are enormous, are historically setting, precedent-setting moistis, such as in our community here, Avos Yisrael, which provides funds and food and clothing for those in need. In New York, of course, you have Temche Shabbos and multitudes. Well, there is also a concept of being responsible for the spiritual well-being. And that, we have also, Baruch Hashem, great moistis who deal with that. They're called Kirov organizations. Right, there's Eish HaTaren or Sameach. I don't want to name them because I might leave out so many of them. Well, one of the ways that the Chazal understood it, when other means don't work, when Yamin Mikareves does not work or has not shown fruit, then unfortunately sometimes for the benefit of the Avarium, for the benefit of the fellow who is not behaving right, he knows the right thing to do, he's been educated, but he refuses to do the right thing for his benefit to motivate him. Unfortunately, sometimes with small doicha, we have to give a patch. And that patch is called a nidui. It's a cherim that Beis Din is empowered and obligated to do. In fact, at the end of Shin Lamed Aleph, right there on the first, in the first sif in Shin Lamed Aleph, the Ramah quotes, and this is where the real discussion starts, Umenadin lemishu chayiv nidui, those who are chayiv nidui, we will put them in that cherim, which by the way meant they can't come into the shul. You can't be in their Dalet Amos. You can have nothing to do with them. You can't incorporate them into a minyan. Even a shaila, whether you could daven if you have a minyan while they're there. All right, that's talked about. But it's an absolute, complete smol deicha. Away, sir. You don't belong in our tzibur.
And are you worried that he will maybe become, it will impact his Yiddishkeit, he'll become less
Zok broke? Rama, that's the Ramah, Reb David. Zok yep. Rama, va'afilu yesh lochush. Here you have this fella. So he's an Avarian. He's not keeping a certain halacha that he's supposed to be keeping. We go and we impose this tremendous patch of a nidui. No one's doing business with you. No one's talking to you. You can't come into our shul. We're erecting machitzas where you go. The guy's going to say, you know what? What do I need this for? Zaymigazint, I'm leaving. Here's my yarmulke. Here's my black hat, my gray hat, my straw hat. You could have it all. I'm off latar b'sra. So here we are, we're trying to protect you. Think about it now, right? We're trying to protect you that you should do the right thing, and you're threatening, not only threatening, we believe, yesh lachosh, there's a real, real possibility here that you're going to go to Tar Basra. Say, I'm sorry, mister, this is what we have to do. If you want to go to Tar Basra, that's your decision, even though it's self-defeating, right? Because we put you in a nidui to bring you back, and it's not working, so maybe we should stop. So l'chari, what you see from here is that the nidui is not only to stop the Avarian from doing his behavior. But it's like what you talked about before, l'man yishmu v'man yiru, that people have to know you need to behave, you need to do the right thing. And we try to do that with guttens. We try to do it by educating people and giving them the beauty and the sweetness of Yiddishkeit and the great affordability and privilege that it is that we are capable of having an intimate relationship with the Rabbeinu Shleilam based on his Torah and mitzvahs. But if that doesn't work, then we have to start thinking about the individual, and we have to start thinking about the people that he might be influencing, even though he's not actively trying to influence anybody, but his mere existence is an influence, and we have to protect the people, even if it means that he'll go off with Arbistraw.
And Rabbi Weiss, yeah. The preponderance of the Paiskim hold like the Ramah, is that fair to say?
Absolutely. It's true that Taz of an art argues very strongly on
but
the Ramah.
But the Shachin, the Nekudas HaKesef,
the
Havas Yoyer, etc.
David, you're the Talmud Chachin himself, you don't even need me here. But the Nekudas HaKesef, the Shach over there, who after a whole litany of riots from the Taz, from Gemaris back and forth, the Nekudas HaShach just says, Ein lachush. We don't have to worry about what the Taz is saying. The imloy kain, but la din yisrael.
Right.
We have to have din yisrael. This is right. Something. It's our privilege. It's our obligation to have din yisrael. And there's a chsam seifa with a tshuva about it. And there's a chavis yoyer. And it's well, well brought through. And I think
now,
this
Rabbi
is important for communities to know that we
Rabbi
have
Weiss,
this obligation.
Continue.
Yeah. Go ahead.
What about going to the children and you say, well, somebody's a terrible avarian, and we're not talking about somebody who did something fine. We're talking about somebody who created a great Chilul Hashem, somebody who's a massive predator, somebody who's impacted us in a substantially material way that's a machriv hatzibur. Are we allowed to say, look, we don't want your children in our school. We don't want your wife to come to shul. You are chutz l'machna. Could we go beyond the person?
Well, that's a very interesting question, and it's a question that has been raised hundreds of years ago, and the Chassam Sofer talks mamish about a very similar case, and the Chavis Yoyer about telling the woman of the Mahrim that she cannot come into the shul. And it's very interesting what the Chassam Sofer says, and a fascinating thing the Chassam Sofer says, you have to hear the Chassam Sofer just to know how far he goes. He says, what about the children? What about the children? So he says, look, this fellow that we've put into a cherem, you know, he has, what's keeping him around is that he has some schusim. What are his schusim? Maybe that his children are having a Jewish education. That's a schus. That's being tail of him. That's keeping him. And why he's not gone and off the scene. And therefore, Zakhtar Chassam Sofer, maybe that's part of our obligation is to take away his schusim, not let him have his children in school, so they won't get a Jewish education, so they won't bring schusim to him. What about their neshamas? that Hashemish you don't have to worry about. They're innocent. The Rabbi Nishan will look at them as innocent. They're an anusim. They would have done the right thing, but they were never given an opportunity. So their neshamas are protected. You don't have to worry about their neshamas. And Fakert, now his neshama, the Avarian's neshama, will get what it finally deserves. An unbelievable tshuva in the Chsam Seifa, in Yerideya, Simin Shin Chaf Beis. But I do want to tell you that at the end of that, the Chsam Seifa says that Hadava Tzaruch Iyun Un Masun, we have to be very patient and we have to look it through, and this has to be done with tremendous trepidance, with tremendous fear, right? V'Hashem Yishmereinu, we have to be protected and know what the right thing to do is. So definitely, even when it would come to a question of their children being brought to school, I mean, in our case, you know, we talked about an outsider coming into our community, so we could be told before, don't come to this community because you're not going to be able to get your children into school.
Very much, Rabbi Weiss. We greatly appreciate having you on.
Thank you. It was very nice talking to you. Be well.
Kolta, bye-bye. We have on the phone with us from New York City, Dr. Shira Berkowitz, who is both a psychologist and an attorney as well, and whose expertise is the prevention of sexual abuse, primarily in children. We'll hear from her. And she's the founder of an organization called Sacred Spaces. Welcome, Dr. Berkowitz.
Thank you.
Can you tell us about what the mission of Sacred Spaces is?
Yes. So Sacred Spaces works with other organizations in the Jewish world. Shuls, yeshivas, schools, camps, to help them prevent abuse. So to start thinking about these issues before it happens through policy development and training, and that if something does happen later, they have a place to turn to, the institution, that will help them to minimize damage to the institution and also at the same time protect others from abuse and support the victim that's been hurt.
So, and I understand you worked for the OU previously. You consulted for them as well.
Yeah, I continue to consult for the OU. I've been working with them for over a decade now. And it's really...
Dr. Berkowitz, tell us, what should we be doing?
Okay. Look, as parents, I'd say that there are two parts of this. One is that you need to educate yourselves. And the second is that you need to educate your children. Educating children is critical, and it's really important, but in the end of the day, we would never place the responsibility of protecting a child on the shoulders of a child. Adults who abuse children, they're older, wiser, stronger, more manipulative, and it's not a child's job to protect themselves. And so when we give them information, we're helping to give them tools. We're also making it more likely that they'll come to us for help, but ultimately it's the parent's job. And so parents need to understand, how do perpetrators operate? What do perpetrators look like? And what are the things that they should be asking of themselves before they let people interact with their children? What should they be talking to their children about? And what should they be demanding of the institutions that their children attend?
So give us a primer. Give us like the Cliff Note version. I'm a parent. What should I be looking for? What does the perpetrator look like? Walk me through it.
Okay. So the first thing you need to know about perpetrators is that they don't wear signs, right? We sort of have this idea of a perpetrator in our mind that they're a monster. And it's just not really a very helpful way of identifying perpetrators, because often perpetrators are the people that we know and trust. The U.S. Department of Justice says that 93% of children who are sexually abused by someone that they know and trust. 34% of the time it's by a family member. Close to 60% of the time it's by an acquaintance. So the idea of stranger danger or the creep in the parking lot or somebody from outside of the from community, it's not an accurate picture. And so we need to understand that this is probably somebody who's very well trusted, probably somebody who looks and in other ways is a really good person who has done really good things. They could appear erlach. And that's why when we think about this issue, we're not focusing on the identity of the person, we're focusing on the behavior. And so if someone is behaving in a manner that crosses any policies we have, crosses boundaries, is inappropriate, if it's an avera and they're crossing halachos or social norms in their interactions with children, these are all red flags. And it doesn't matter if it's a spouse, a parent, a sibling, a rabbi, a rabbi's child, all of these people could potentially be somebody who would abuse a child. And so we don't
want to
walk around.
And to just add on to it.
That's exactly what it looks like. One person who was convicted of sexually abusing a child from person, he said to me, you know, niceness was a strategy that I used. I made sure that I did the most chesed in the community. I was the person that people could trust.
I did the most chesed in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Continue.
And,
amazing.
And it was intentional. This was a strategy that he was using. And so when people accused him, when the accusations came out, he was the last person anyone would imagine because he had gone to such great lengths to establish himself as a person who could never do something like this. And so even though people saw it with their own eyes, they bent over backwards for all sorts of explanations of why somebody would be acting in this way.
So you're a parent. So give us the two or three things you should be aware of. Give us a small hand guide. You say it's somebody you trust, very likely trust, and actually works on building community reputation. What else? Give us the handbook for the parent.
Okay. And it doesn't have to be that person, but it often is. Look, it's somebody who is going, there's a term that we use, it's called grooming, and it's all the preliminary behavior that comes before abusing. So most of the time, as a parent or as a bystander, you're not going to see somebody abuse a child, but you're going to see the steps that come first. And these are the things you want to be on the lookout for. So the perpetrator will groom a child and the child's family and the community. So they get them to like them. Once they're past that step and they're in and they're trusted, now they're going to try to get a child alone. Maybe they're going to be violating that child's boundaries or the parents' boundaries, disregarding things. So it could be a person who is offering to babysit for free all the time. The person wants to tutor. All these things that could be very innocent and wonderful things, but they're so interested in your child, like more than they're interested in doing their own things. They seem too good to be true because they are too good to be true. Maybe they're initiating a discussion about topics that are just not SNIAS, right? So they want to talk to your – they want to be the one who always talks to your child about Shomer Nagia. Maybe they want to mentor your son and have a conversation about Shiv Chasera. They want to talk about the language. Maybe they're violating Nivel Pet, you know, things like that. They're crossing boundaries. Maybe you see them. Maybe the child sees them. But they're trying to get your kid alone, and they're spending a lot of time with your child.
Okay. And that's something that a age profile, if you took 100, you know, molesters, what would it look like? You know, as far as relation, is it X percent family, X percent older, X percent younger?
Right.
Can you try to give us some profile?
Yeah, so 1/3 of individual children are themselves children.
Okay.
So these are juveniles. And maybe when we're talking about the behavior of the child, of the child who's perpetrating the abuse, we wouldn't call it sexual abuse. We might say it's a sexual behavior problem. There can be all sorts of reasons they're engaging in this. It doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to grow up to be a pedophile. But what the victim is experiencing is still sexual abuse. And so one third
are friends. Right, same age.
They could be older. They could be older children. It's often older children targeting younger children.
Okay.
If a child is the same age and there's no coercion used, no differential of power, then we wouldn't call that abuse. We might call that other things. So this is usually, when we're talking about children, it's either a child who is using a position of power to force a child, or they're significantly older, so like a babysitter or a camp counselor. Then of the others, what we know is that they tend to be typical. So they tend to be married, like most of the population tends to be married. They tend to be educated. They tend to be in heterosexual relationships, which is important because if an adult male molests a young boy, people will say, it's not possible. He's married to this wonderful woman. But that doesn't mean anything when it comes to abuse. So they just really look very typical. Sometimes it might be an indicator if you see somebody who has never had a relationship with, has never been in a significant relationship with anybody of their own age, doesn't seem to have friends of their own age, is only interested in children. That would be a red flag.
What percentage is it family members?
34%, according to the U.S. Department of Justice.
And that would be parents, siblings, uncles, aunts, the whole gamut.
Right.
And what percentage is it, let's say, teachers and, you know, like, you know, older of power?
Yeah. So there's a study done by the Department of Education that found that 10%, close to 10%, I think it was 9.6% of students had been sexually assaulted or solicited, harassed by personnel in the public schools. So these were educators.
10% were harassed. What percentage of children in general are, would you say, are
right.
Dr. Berkowitz, we've had Dr. From Mahmoudzim, Tzvi Gluck, and he says that there are approximately 100 suicides a year in our community. That's 100 a year, two a week. And he says the vast majority have been sexually molested when they were children. As a professional, would you think that conclusion is reasonable?
I don't know. I can't answer that. But if Tzvi is saying that that's his experience clinically working with this population, then he is in a position to know best. I will say that the risk of suicide goes up significantly for a child who has been abused, along with a lot of other potential adverse consequences, such as all sorts of things like alcohol dependency, depression, anxiety, and even health-related risks that we would never think about, such as heart disease, liver disease, cancer, dying younger. All of these things have been found. All children who have been abused even one time have been found to be at increased risk for these adverse outcomes. Now, we can promote resiliency, and we can help children to heal. And certainly there are a lot of things that adults can do to help that happen. But if Tzvi is saying that this is his experience, he would know.
So when a parent is approached by a child or the parent sees something wrong, ask the child and the child says them, what would you say the parent do?
Okay. I would say there are a number of steps to this. First of all, you have to recognize when a child discloses abuse. Most of the time, children aren't disclosing. They're scared. They're worried. They love the perpetrator. There are so many, they don't want to get the parents upset. There are so many reasons why a child might not disclose. So if a child is disclosing, much of the time it's accidental or they're disclosing tentatively and they're testing your reaction. I'll tell you a story that happened to me recently. A child approached me and he said to me, you know, Shira, there are a lot of bad kids in my class. And I said, really, tell me more about that. And so he said, well, 2 years ago when I was younger, they all were under a tree during recess, and, well, I don't really remember what else happened. At that point, I said, I just want to tell you that if there's something you need to tell me, I want you to know you're not going to get in trouble for telling me, and you can tell me whatever it is you need to tell me. So then he said, oh, I remember we were under the tree and these boys had pinned down another boy and they were pulling down his pants and I don't remember what happened next. So then I said, I want you to know that not only will you not get in trouble, but if there were other boys who did things that they shouldn't have been doing, they won't get in trouble, but we might need to get them some help and we need to make sure that everybody behaves in a way that feels safe. And then he remembered the rest of the story and remembered that, in fact, it wasn't another boy they were doing this to, but that this had happened to him. This had happened to himself, and he was sharing that with me. And so I share that just so that parents can understand a disclosure is not necessarily going to be straightforward, and you have to listen to what your child is saying. When they say this to you, stay calm. It's very normal to feel panic or denial or to get upset at somebody, right? Because this is a terrible thing they're telling you. But try to stay really calm. Believe the child, even if you doubt the child. It's okay to doubt the child. Just don't tell them that you doubt them. Keep that to yourself, and you believe the child. And that's your moment. The second the child discloses, that's your opportunity to start building resiliency right there. And research shows that the way you respond can impact the trajectory for this child. So instead of saying to the child something like, you poor kid, that's so terrible, you couldn't even do anything, there was nothing you could have done, and like victimizing him with your language, say things like, I'm so glad you're safe right now. You handled that so well. I'm so proud of you for telling me. Thank you for telling me. Honor the child, build them up with your language, and tell them that you will help them and that if they feel unsafe, they should come back to you, and then you report it and you take care of that child. And as parents, we can even take this a step back. We don't need to get to this point, right? As parents, it's not our job to wait until we know and have proof that there's abuse. If we are seeing the signs of grooming, if somebody is violating the principles, the halachos, or whatever it is, they're going across the boundaries, and we have these early warning signs, that is a gift. That is a gift to have the early warning signs, and it's our responsibility then to intervene and take care of our children. And that's it. It doesn't...
So give us the four... Give us, like, just the snapshot of the four rules a parent should have.
Okay. I'd say that you want to think about the concept of yichud in terms
yichud.
Of, yeah, so...
Yichud, the same isura yichud that you have between a teenage boy and a teenage girl, we have with a child as well. You
yeah.
should not be alone behind a locked door or closed door with a member of your own sex or a different sex, no matter how friendly, no matter how chashuv, no matter how related they are, doors are open.
Correct. We have the principles of interruptible and observable. They apply in Yichud in the traditional sense, and they should apply here as well. So everything should always be interruptible and observable, and adults should be open and receptive to modeling the safe behavior. When I go over to somebody's house for lunch and a child says, come to my bedroom, I want you to see, Shira, come look at my stuffed animals, I say, sure. One, let's check in with your parents. Two, let's bring somebody else with us. Right? It doesn't mean we have to get our kids all scared. It just means we start modeling the safe behavior. So that's one of them.
Can I just add on to this? You know, I employ many, many women and men too for 30 years or so. And I've never, ever had a single case where a woman has accused me of impropriety. And the reason is I have a rule. If there's a woman in the office, the door is open. If she wants the door closed, there has to be somebody else in the office together with her. Chazal figured this out 2,000 years ago. It's just following the laws of Yichud. If we follow the halacha that Chazal gave us, we will stay out of trouble. Simple.
It's amazing.
So that's rule number one and two. Give us another one.
Okay, so, you know, there are the basic things you want to talk to your children about. So nobody should be touching them in any of their private parts, and you're going to use words, anatomically correct words, to identify their body parts. They need to be able to know what their body parts are so that they can talk to you and tell you if somebody's touched them. And, you know, you might give exceptions to that, and you always explain it, right? So if you're at the doctor, Ima is with you or Tati is with you, and that's why it's okay because the doctor is touching you for a healthy touch, and I am here in the room. But if somebody ever violates your safety rules, you can always come to me and I will help you. And this is, I would say, is very critical because sometimes what happens is that children are taught by their parents or by their schools what is allowed and what isn't allowed, right? No adult should ever touch you there, right? Or nobody else should ever touch you there. And then when that happens, if they're abused, they feel that they can't tell, they'll get in trouble because their parents taught them not to do this, right? And so we have to be really clear that you have permission to say no if someone is violating your safety rule, but you could also come and tell me, even if something happens, and I'm going to help you, and you will not get in trouble. So there's that, which is important. You want to help your children, and this part can be really fun, to create a safety network of, let's say, 5 trusted adults. And this is easier for younger children. As kids get older, they start to have trouble with picking 5 adults. But the younger kids can pick lots and lots, right? And you come up with 5 trusted adults, and you maybe make a game out of this, and you then you can do role plays, you can act this out with your kids, and you teach them. If somebody makes you feel uncomfortable, if someone makes you feel an uh-oh feeling, if someone tries to get you to do an Avera, if somebody tries to violate your rules, you tell one of these adults, and you keep telling until you are believed and somebody helps you.
We don't keep secrets.
So an adult should never be asking a child to keep a secret.
No secrets.
And if somebody asks your child to keep a secret, the first thing they should do is come tell you. I'm sorry?
Well, Dr. Berkowitz, this was fantastic. And, you know, we reach, you know, thousands and thousands of listeners. So this is really tremendous mitzvah of Loisamed Aldam Reyecha, of Hashava Saveda, of Lifna Iver, you know, of preventing it. And did you ever see the Yanky Horowitz book about protecting
yes.
our children? Isn't that a wonderful book?
It's fantastic.
Yeah,
it's
I suggest.
Really great.
Really, Yanky Horowitz, I don't remember the name, but it sold, it was, I think, Art Scroll's number one bestseller last year about protecting, and it's now in Yiddish and Hebrew and English. He just did a really fantastic job, and I encourage everybody. Yeah, Dr. Berkowitz, thank you very much. We wish you a lot of hatzlacha with your program, Sacred Spaces, and thank you for sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you for inviting me here.
All the best.
Bye.
Phone with us, Mr. David Framowitz. From Bnei Brak, Eretz Yisrael, Israel, who is a survivor of abuse, who has the courage to relate to us his experience. Welcome, Mr. Framowitz.
Hi, how are you?
Could you tell us you know, a little bit about what occurred to you, and then we'll follow up with questions?
All right. When I was a student at Yeshiva Tar V'Das of Naples, which is now known as Yeshiva Tar Tanima, I was in 7th grade. In the class of Rabbi Simcha Kaufman, I used to get rides in the morning to the yeshiva with Yudi Koko, who lived at that time on 56th Street. Between 14th and 15th Avenue. And he used to drive us in the morning to yeshiva. And all of a sudden, one morning, he decided, you know what, David, come sit in the front seat. And not knowing anything better, I went and sat in the front seat. When we got to the Ocean Parkway, where the yeshiva was located, we had a few boys in the car. The boys in the back seat got out of the car, and I was ready to get out of the car. And he said to me, no, David, stay in the car. I want to talk to you a few minutes. And I stayed, and then he said, come closer. And he pulled me over on top of to sit on his lap. And then he started fondling me. And this was about 8:30 in the morning. School started at 9, 8:30, a quarter to 9. I was shocked. I was an 11-year-old boy, not knowing what was going on. After a few minutes, he said, okay, you can go back, you can go out now to class. And totally bewildered, went to class, came home, didn't say anything to anybody that time. And I said, you know what? It'll go, it'll pass. 2 or 3 days later, I decided, you know what, I didn't know what happened, couldn't understand it. I went back because we were getting these usually morning lists with Rabbi Koko. So I went back to where we got the lists, which was in front of his house. And he didn't say anything. I got in the car. And we drove to the yeshiva with several other boys in the car. And then when we got to the yeshiva, in front of the yeshiva, he said, David, you stay in the car a few minutes. I want to talk to you. And all the other boys left. Then all of a sudden, he started the car again. And once down on East 5th Street, or East 4th, I don't remember which one it was, he parked the car. He told me to come in the front seat. And he pulled me over on top of him. And once again, started molesting me, putting his hands down the front of my pants. What can I say?
Did you tell anybody?
After afterwards, that afternoon when I got home, I told my parents. But for whatever reasons, they did not understand. They were not willing to realize that such things happen. And they didn't believe me or couldn't believe me. A few days later, walking in the hallways of the yeshiva, I bumped into him again. And it was an early day. We were getting out early for some reason. I don't remember what. And he said, "Boy, come. I'm driving home. I'll drive you home." And I was sort of hesitant. He said, "No, don't worry. Everything's fine." Again, I was just 11 years old. And I unfortunately went with him. And he drove into Borough Park, stopped on a side street, I don't remember which one, pulled me over again, and started molesting me again. Months later, he did not bother me, he did not do anything. Then, I'd say about 3 months later, he saw me walking down his block, because I decided I'm not going to take any more lifts with him. And I passed his house, and he saw me, and he called me over, and he says, "I have to talk to you." And I said, "No." He says, "Yes, I have to talk to you." And he pulled me into his car. And I was scared. And once again, he drove towards the yeshiva. I don't remember where we ended up on. And I got molested again. That summer, I was a camper in Camp Aguda.
Did you tell them, anybody in the yeshiva?
I did not tell anybody in the yeshiva.
Can you, David, how has this affected you in your life? I have to tell you that I admire the courage that it takes for you to come on. And the reason I ask you is because hopefully we do have thousands and thousands of parents listening. And it's important that they know that when their child comes over to them, that they should believe it and understand the impact of it. So if you don't, and if any time you feel uncomfortable, just say, "Let's move to another." How has that affected you in your life?
How that affected me? Look, we're talking about something that occurred when I was 11 years old. That's 47 years ago. It's been 47 years of constantly thinking and reenacting everything in one's head. You don't forget. It's there. You have to keep on living. You have to keep on pushing. You have to keep being a survivor and be strong. had bitachon and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that just because there are sick people in this world, you didn't do anything wrong. You have better days and you have worse days, and you have wonderful days. I, Baruch Hashem, have a wonderful family, wonderful children, wonderful grandchildren, wonderful wife. 1983, I decided we're making Aliyah, moving to Eretz Yisrael, getting away from Brooklyn. I couldn't see myself sending my children to any yeshiva such as Torah Tanima, or having to any have to do with any of that world where Banim don't believe you. No one is ostracized. Today I know that everybody knew about Coco. Everybody in all the camps and all the yeshivas, everybody knew that Coco was a molester. And no one did anything for years and years and years. And I myself sometimes feel guilty that I didn't come out much later and file a report with anybody. Not with the officials, not with the police. And I kept on telling myself over the years, look, no one said anything. I don't hear anything. I don't hear anybody in any rumors. I remember when the internet first started coming up in the late 1990s, I used to check the internet all the time, typing the name Coco, saying, okay, if something was there, somebody would say something over all these years, and nothing happened. Until 2005, when I finally saw on the UOJ website, on the blogs, they're starting to talk about Yidi Coco and how there's rumors of him being molesting children. I said, you know what? This is my siman, min shamayim, that I've been waiting for all these years, to tell my story, that there really is something there, that the guy is a molester. That I wasn't just, it wasn't just me. He molested me afterwards in Camp Aguda for 2 summers in a row. When I was a camper, 12 years old, he used to take me out into the forest, push me against a tree, and rub himself against me, or pull me into his car and drive out of the camp with me in the car and pull over to the side of the road somewhere and molest me in the car. I was a 12-year-old boy. What did I know? Who knew anything about those things in those days?
So David, if Yuri Coco is listening, what would you tell him?
He should rot in hell. He should be ashamed of going to shul. He should not be given an aliyah in any shul. He should not be given any kavod. The guy is a lowlife. He ruined dozens and dozens of boys. I've met with dozens of victims of Yidi Coco over the past 10 years. I met someone who was in the Meir Yeshiva before he even came to Tarv Tamima, Tarv Adasa Flapush. Coco was a dorm counselor or something was happening to the dorm. And the guy told me that he was molested in the dorms of Nir. Okay, Coco's been doing this for decades. I met people in all along the East Coast, in Florida, and North Carolina, and South Carolina, in New York, upstate. All have been molested by Coco over the years, and everybody knew.
Do most of the survivors do they suffer with it on an ongoing basis? Do they have any survivors committed suicide, which is unfortunately not infrequent by children are molested or go off the derech? Do you know of either?
I know of several that gone off the derech. I do not know if anyone's gone who has committed suicide. I don't know. Never met them, do not know. But the guy not only Coco, but all the people who covered it up over the years. Margolis, Rabbi Margolis knew about it. People have talked to him. There was an investigation in the 90s where parents came to Margolis and they set up a base to look into it. Okay. I know some
other rabbis knew about it too. Well, David, thank you very much. And believe me, that we're going to be playing not the entire segment, but big chunks of it on our program.
Okay.
Okay. All the best. Thank you very much. Shabbat Shalom.
Bye.